If you are just joining us for part two of Cindy Atman's interview on the podcast, I strongly encourage you to go back and listen to part one. Two reasons. One, we took one full episode and split it into two, so it'll seem a little weird to just jump into the interview in part two if you don't go back and listen to part one. And the other is just because it was so rich and had so much depth and so much that we could learn from it. So I really, really strongly encourage you to go back and listen to part one. But since you're here, know that we jump right in around question three of the interview and talk to Dr. Atman about her thoughts around what are critical skills of leaders in engineering education and how critical is our leadership to the vitality of the field. So enjoy and thank you for always listening. Growth, right? With all these centers and all these new departments, having some time to reflect in your career trajectory and having led and watched others stand up and lead engineering education centers and departments, what are some of the key knowledge, skills, and attributes that you think aspiring leaders in these spaces should possess?
That is such a good question. I spent a long time actually thinking about the answer to this question because, like, it's so many lessons, so little time. In academia, what happens, you're good at scholarship, and then they promote you to a leadership role and you get no training, right? Like, plop, you're there you are. And so I had many lessons learned by hard knocks. The two passes at the answer. The first one is, like, always learning, always learning. I teach a course on teamwork that I just love teaching. And a lot of these things I talk about in this. One of my colleagues who I co-taught the course with once brought in a framework of educational principles that was from a Medium article by Liz Chatterton. And the principles that she listed being important are for any kind of teamwork. Psychological safety, trust and reliability, shared purpose, clear roles and goals, tools and tech. And then whenever I teach it with my students, I also add communication because, like, you can't do anything without good communication. If I had known, like, as I was running centers, I could experience that things were like, that these things were important, but I didn't have the language to name them. I knew we had to have shared purpose. I knew everybody needed to know what to do, but I didn't think about psychological safety and trust. I could feel them, but I didn't know how to articulate them. And being able to articulate them is really important. And if I had actually known this framework going in, a lot of the other hard-earned lessons, I think, maybe wouldn't have happened. So I would say, this is what I teach. It's the spine. This is what the spine of my teamwork class, like, the base is psychological safety and trust for you and for other people. And it's like, things aren't going to happen well if that isn't there. And then, like, I have a list of a couple of dozen of my learnings. I'm not going to read all of them to you. I'll mention a few. I figure I should write this up somehow. I should take these notes somehow and write them up. I don't know where I
I
would
see a
probably.
book. I see a
Okay.
book.
Oh no, not a book. I want to write a book on design, but maybe, I don't know. Let's talk about it. Maybe the three of us can write a book. We can, like, what are you learning there? What are these things? Let's think about it. Okay. So some of the things I learned. Mention a few and sort of, like, in some categories. So as a leader, you need to know about yourself, like, know yourself and why you're doing things. and pick your battles. And if it's not fun, don't do it. If it's not fun for you, like, don't persist. You need to be doing something else. Like, pause and reconfigure. About people in general, we're all humans. We all make mistakes. And you never know what somebody else has gone through in their journey to get into whatever situations you're in right now. And it's important to remember that. I have a very favorite quote from Mark Twain, and that is, there's a lot of human nature in people. And it's so true. And, you know, I learn that every day. About interactions among people, communication is like the most important thing. Good communication is 80% listening and 20% talking. And us professors, we are promoted on professing. We're promoted on our out. Yes, exactly, Jeremy. We're promoted on our output. It's like blah, 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 blah. And if you aren't listening to someone else, if you're just thinking about what you're going to say next, you miss the whole boat. And so particularly important for a leader to think about listening is the most important thing. And then if you're dealing with a challenge, using the frame, I learned this from HR, and this was from the School of Hard Knocks for sure, that there's a difference often between somebody's intent and impact. And if you frame something, if there's something that's going on, you don't know what's going on in that person's life, but if there's some way that something could be made easier, a way to talk about it with people that is not confrontational and it makes sense and it's very human is, I'm sure that you're intending X, but the impact on me is Y. And so how can we like navigate the difference between what you're intending and the impact? And that's a very human way to have a conversation. And then bring chocolate is another really important thing. about the situation. So we've talked about yourself, people in general, interactions. Then I have situation and then the process. So about the situation, it's super important to know your context. Like, where are you? Who's listening? What's the message? It's important to know points of inflection. I learned this from Gerhard Fischer from Colorado. He run a center. He's like, oh, I hear you're doing this. I'm like, what should I know? And he said, points of inflection particularly in leadership, are places where you need to just get your radars up, because like, who knows what can happen when leadership changes. And then about the process itself. Well, one more thing about a situation. Like, we all know academics, it's fake, right? It's fake human interactions. It's not real world stuff. Henry Kissinger has this quote, academic politics are so nasty because the stakes are so low. Isn't that hysterical? There's this great New Yorker cartoon. Like, we are, as a community, we're colleagues and we're collaborators, but we're competitors at the same time, right? We all go in for the same NSF money. We peer review each other's papers. We have this, it's a very unique setup of interactions among people. And so it's, you really need to remember, like, people are human and people get hurt, you know? And this great cartoon where, let's see, there's like lab rats talking with each other, like in a little fishbowl kind of thing. And there's two scientists up above, and they say, looking at the lab rats, they say, okay, let's slowly lower in the grant money. Like, oh. Who gets the resources? Who doesn't? Like, how do you not be like human about why didn't I get that? You know, we're all, it's really hard. It's hard. And then about the process itself of working with each other. super important to be explicit about your decision-making process. So I did not do this for years. I just assumed everybody would be wanting doing consensus. And if you can't get to consensus, you need an alternative. And you need to be explicit with people, because then people are like, my decision didn't, you know, my idea was discounted. And that can cause bad feelings. Information flow and reporting. I already talked about Jennifer, Jim, and Ken, and I designed a consortium to promote reflection specifically on the principles of transparency and peer accountability, like group accountability, because when you're running a center, like a national center, with collaborators who are all other faculty, like there isn't a hierarchy. There, you have responsibility to NSF to get a final report in, but you have no authority to tell your colleague to get something to you. And so if they don't, then you're stuck. But what we did was we didn't have anybody have to report or submit anything to us as like the PI. We submitted it to everybody else. So like everything was done with everybody being able to see it. And I know if I'm going to give my homework to Canvas, we do this with our students too. I have students submit assignments on Google Slide decks to all of their peers, not just to me on Canvas. And like in a credit, no credit course increases the quality amazingly, because you don't want to embarrass yourself with your peers. And that wasn't like the point with our colleagues in CPRI. But it is like, you know, instead of having people give stuff to me as director, it's like we give it to with everybody. And so group accountability was great. And then the last one is expectation management. And that is, people are disappointed if you don't meet their expectations. And if somebody does not have realistic expectations, you're totally sunk. Like you can't ever meet what they expect you to do. Like, you know, okay, you need $5 million. Sorry, but the grant sources are only 2 million. Like you'll never meet it. So managing up, like managing what somebody's expectations are so that they're realistic or maybe even lower than what you can do, then you're building success stories. So that's about the process itself. So that got really long, sorry. But and then also bring chocolate. That's a process thing too.
I like it how chocolate made a cameo, not once, but twice.
Yes, absolutely. Fair trade.
Can you speak to the importance of these leadership roles to the vitality and sustainability of centers and departments? You've kind of given us like what they should know, but like, how critical is it?
Okay, to build on the importance of chocolate, and this is the kind of thing that takes chocolate over many, many years, I'd like to talk a little bit about ideas of leadership at the field-wide level, so across engineering education. We are still such a new field. You know, the centers, as I have been talking about, centers and departments are new. Substantial level of funding at the National Science Foundation has been incredible, but none of these things are carved in stone. They can come and go. My center has actually ebbed and flowed. We can't depend on National Science Foundation funding without nurturing it. And so mechanical engineering is a field that's been here forever and always will be, you know, and we are not like mechanical engineering. We're not like data science engineering, which is where sort of like the whole global field is going. We're a niche field at the moment. And when Sue Chemnitzer told us as the CAEE leadership team that the funding for the future of the field of engineering education was resting on the quality of the report, it was supremely stressful for us. But it was absolutely true. You know, it was only a few years into funding the field. It was a big bet. It was a lot of money. And if we had blown it, then it would have been hard for Sue to make the internal arguments to actually keep the funding of the field going. And so I want to make that point, because all of us as members of this field, when we have opportunities where we can advocate for our field, then it's important for us to do that at whatever level we are, you know, whether it's talking with a colleague in the hallway, or whether it's talking with our department chair to see what the dean needs, or when it's talking with our engineering education program officers at NSF, what does the new engineering director of the engineering division need in terms of evidence for our field? So it's just super important for all of us to be figuring out how to advocate for our field so that we stick around. So this podcast is a perfect example of all the work that you all are doing and collecting the stories and building up an archive so that the community can point to and say, ah, this is what we're doing. So contributions like this are super important for all of us to be thinking about at whatever level we are. And so making sure people know what you're doing and how well you're doing it. And so messaging and communicating is super important. For anybody, and knowing the grain size of the communication, like what communication should be and like how often they should be. And then in terms of the leadership strategies to make sure that you're surviving and doing well, I think, like, picking from what I talked about, knowing your context is super important. Building teams based on psychological safety and trust and reliability, that's the only thing I think of going forward. Expectation management and listening, and then chocolate.
Thank you.
Yes, I appreciate it. I think this is probably one of a few podcasts where they mentioned chocolate, so I'm a big fan. So I just want to close in on talking about you as a scholar, and I mean, there's so much we could say. We could have a whole different podcast on design, and we may. But in light of this discussion on centers, can you think about, like, your greatest impact, what that has been in terms of, like, a researcher or an educator, a member of the community? What do you perceive as or some of the greatest impact?
So, you know what, I asked, so one of my colleagues said I should ask ChatGPT this question. So I did. It was pretty funny what they said. There's a little bit of overlap with what I would say. And I guess I would say here, that's for others to say, not me. on the scholarship side of thing, you mentioned design. Deed, the Engineering Design Education Division at ASCE, asked me to give a distinguished lecture this year at ASCE on my research on design. So I would invite people to come to that. And I think ERM is co-sponsoring it. The title is Design Signatures, A Journey from Design Expertise to Design Awareness. So I did and this is also a huge team of people who did this with me. Lots of research on how people actually do design in an expert novice kind of framing, and seeing that there's huge differences between how experts do design and how first year students and graduating students do design. And it did, you know, if my goal of my scholarship is to help try to figure out how to teach engineers to think more broadly, the differences between students and experts really show some gaps where we could teach students that it's super important to scope out a problem, to have lots of ideas, to gather information throughout and to iterate. That body of work, that set of papers is sort of like on the scholarship side. But my recent scholarship has been building on that and doing the translational work to try to get it out into practice. And so that's the concept of design signatures, which, you know, we mostly teach design now by saying, here, go do capstone. So people do it. And what we're trying to do is figure out ways to provide reflective moments for students to learn about their process and about expert processes. And a design signature can be sort of like a tracing of design activities over time, I have these timelines which show ways that people can engage in design over time across design activities. Worked with fabulous students here. We now have an app that you can download and you can actually track your own design process, either for synchronous, like short projects, or asynchronous ones like a capstone. We created a 10-week seminar called Dear Design, based on the Dear Data book. I don't know if you know that, but postcards of, so we have students do design and then write a postcard. So we have a website called designsignatures.org where you can see 200 postcard representations of design processes that engineers wrote. Like it's just, they're beautiful. Right now I'm so excited. I'm working with a set of people across the country. We're calling ourselves the Design Signatures in the Wild group. It's Susanna Howe and Reed Bailey and Daria Cota-Schwartz and Micah Landy, Eli Patton, Nicole Petruni, Karina Patel, Juliana Flores, Eileen Zhang, and Jennifer, of course. We're capturing student processes with like paper and pencil bubble sheets and our app, but also just Google Sheets and spreadsheets, and showing them to students. And students are going, oh my gosh, I never thought about that. And so this fabulous group, we're doing a workshop at ASCE and some of us at the Capstone conference this year. We proposed to do one at FYE and FYE, the first year engineering education conference in Boston. And so we're getting this stuff out on the road. So it's super, super exciting for me that my design work is really getting out there. So that's the education work too. I also am very proud of my teamwork class. I need to write about that because that's bringing in like those leadership concepts. But I think you alluded to and you know, the what I'm super proud of was just my role in helping to provide places for community as the field was growing. So both KELT, the campus-based ones, pulling together people to talk about centers in the Engineering Education Centers group, CAEE, the first center in the country, you know, 100 people involved in that center, like really focused on research, and the current Design Signatures in the Wild, you know, I think so. Maybe a couple themes for me are risk-taking, like I just did stuff I never knew anything about and made lots of mistakes, but also finding the right people to work with, like makes things joyful. So super proud of being part of the community. And you can see some of the Jeremy mentioned the Pioneers Project at the very beginning, where, and some classes are actually using this in their classes, because I hear when the website goes down, like, hey, but Charlie Okamoto, so do you know the name Charlie Okamoto? He was at IUPUI and one of the most enthusiastic, amazing educators ever, like ASCE, like you always wanted to see Charlie. And he told me one year that he was retiring. And I was like, no, you can't do that because the people aren't going to know you. You know, like you remember a conference and you don't know what city you were in, but like, I remember being at the top of the escalator at this carpet with these big pink red flowers, you know, and Charlie saying, what, you can't retire. How are people going to know you? So that the idea came about to try to capture pioneer stories as people were retiring. And then also because Jennifer and Ken were involved, to try to grow the community by, like, Jeremy was a grad student. And what better way to grow the community than to have new grad students interview oldsters to learn specifically one person, but also to know each other, like, you know, as you were students, and write the stories. And so they're on the website. We interviewed as many people as we could, you know, had the funding to do. It would have been great to continue it. I, parenthetical note, I have to admit, my profile is still not up there. It's kind of a funny story why it's not. You know, maybe since this is very public, if I promise this audience, I will get it up there in the summer. maybe I could put some of the leadership things at the, like, I could do a postscript or something. I could take advantage of the fact that I was a decade or so late. So anyway, maybe
I would love that.
Accountability.
Yeah.
Perfect. Group accountability. That's exactly right.
There you go. It's the time of the podcast where we now ask you to make a prediction. It's prediction time. Where do you see engineering education going? If you had a crystal ball and could predict the future of engineering education, what would you see or say?
Yeah, crystal balls, those things. I don't know. If you were able to get one, would you want one? That's kind of a philosophical question, isn't it? Yeah. I think as I was like thinking of this question, I hadn't thought about the crystal ball question, but I was thinking, okay, like if I come, since I was thinking setting the stage back in the early 90s, like comparing the early 90s to now, what differences do I see? And if I think about like what, like engineering education in general, like what we're teaching and in the, can you, my dog is 15 and a half and he's coughing in the background there. So you might be hearing my little tugster.
Okay.
If I'm looking at engineering education in general and like what we're teaching and how we're teaching it in engineering classrooms, it's really different now. It's pretty darn interesting. If we look at what we teach, like fields have expanded. There are new fields. You know, it was just basically, you know, civil, mechanical, chemical, and bioengineering is really new. You know, now there's nano engineering and data science engineering. There's a recognition that the world is more complicated than we thought, you know, so ecosystems and systems thinking, that problems are more complicated than we thought, you know, the language of wicked problems, the National Academy of Engineering grand challenges, like engineers, we have to be part of the solution to these grand challenges. And also a recognition that, you know, engineers not only contribute to solutions, but contribute to problems, you know, not just specifically with the technologies, but also in the social structures that are out there and that we help perpetuate. So there's more nuances in recognizing what to teach. But there's still like huge challenges. The New York Times front page of the Sunday New York Times 2 days ago, March 31st, can we engineer ourselves out of a climate crisis? Can we engineer ourselves out of a climate crisis? Can you believe that? You know, they're using the word engineer instead of control or manipulate. You know, it's interesting how the word engineer is being used. Scientists and engineers know better now. We know that ecosystems are very delicately balanced. You know, my great uncle in the 40s, that they didn't know that back then, but we know it now. The problems are bigger and we're responsible for it. And so like, you know, we're partly responsible. And so things are more pressing. That's what we teach. How we teach, way different. Like it was Sage on the Stage in the 90s. We have so much active learning and problem-based learning and project-based learning. It's not ubiquitous, but it's solidly there. And then of course, recent technologies, you know, the pandemic, virtual teaching, way different. AI, oh my gosh, that's going to change a lot. Assessment, another large category in the 90s, you know, we were counting beans and now we have outcomes-based assessment. Took a huge effort, but now it's standard of what we're doing. So what and how we're teaching engineering, there's a lot the same, but there's a lot different. And in terms of the field of engineering education research, like looking at what we're doing research on and how we're doing it, the community of people is far more diverse, which is just fabulous in race and ethnicity and background and more global and just amazing. Looking at methods, like in the 90s, we were trying to tell people that, you know, qualitative methods is a thing, you know, not just quantitative methods, you can do qualitative stuff, you know, and now like there's a rich set of methods that are out there. It's like, oh, finally. Theories are now more explicitly part of the work. And so it's really good to see that we're building theories, and work is based on theory. And the questions that our field is focusing on are much broader and more nuanced. Jennifer and Robin Adams and I had a paper in 2005 called Research on Engineering Student Knowing, Trends and Opportunities. And we were choosing papers to demonstrate as breadth as we could on methods and topics. And they were things like engineering concepts and concept maps as a method and tools to measure adaptive expertise and characteristics of freshman engineering. Just look at the most recent JEE. And there's articles such as Eurocentric Epistemologies in Engineering, Manifestations in First Year Student Design Teams and Consequences for Student Learning. Learning to prioritize the public good. Does training in classes, workplaces, and professional societies shape engineers' understanding of their public welfare responsibilities? So just fabulous broad set of questions. And then looking to the future, sort of like both what we teach and what we research, I would challenge us, like if we look at the future of topics that we're teaching, and acknowledging the interdisciplinary nature of the world's problems and how fast knowledge bodies are growing. Like we always hear about the PACT curriculum, like how are you going to add that to the PACT curriculum? A few years ago, I proposed not too tongue in cheek, you know, somewhat, but what if we actually proposed an engineering curriculum that was based on, that included lifelong learning, ethics, an engineering mindset, so that would include like design and systems thinking, and a few technical details. Like, what would it look like if instead of maximizing, if we minimized what we teach? What if we, like, what's the minimum viable product of an engineering education that's necessary to be called an engineer? And so that's just sort of a fun challenge I'm throwing out that maybe somebody will take up and go, oh, okay, you know, let's completely reconfigure it.
Very cool. So we're, believe it or not, we're winding down to the end of this. I mean, you've dropped a lot of knowledge and pithy quotes and just really words of wisdom. So as we wrap up, I'll ask my last question in that, one, is there any piece of like pithy advice that you feel like everyone should hear? And or are there names of people that others should have on their radars? I kind of want to tie these two ideas together.
So first, before I dive in and answer your question, I want to say thank you for the invitation to have this conversation with you. And also, like at a much larger level, thank you to Ruth for starting this podcast. And so much thank you to both of you for carrying it on. It takes so much work to do this kind of thing, but it's an enormous contribution to the field. And I know the field really appreciates it.
Thank you.
Yeah, so wrapping together these two questions and thinking about the community level rather than the individual level for people following. Fabulous that the community, like ASCE, has developed new divisions as the community has grown. Like on faculty development, Jim and Ken were part of pulling that together. You know, faculty development is a whole field. The new equity, culture, and social justice division. So really showing where people are caring about. Haven't been to ASCE since the pandemic, but did get to the Harvey Mudd, Clive Dim Harvey Mudd Engineering Design Workshop a year or so ago, and was completely blown away by the young scholars who were there. Diverse and energetic and asking fabulously important and deep questions and using a range of methods and theories. And I literally just sat back at the end of the conference and felt like the field is in a good place. You know, the field is in good hands. And it was, and just feeling really proud to be part of, you know, I can't answer the questions I was putting to myself a couple decades ago myself, but the field can. And then sort of like, if I were to give young Cindy some advice, you know, Kierkegaard, we live our lives forward and understand them backwards, you know, hopefully what I talked about today sounded coherent, but that was looking backwards. And looking forwards, I had lots of dead ends and false starts and screw ups. And, you know, back to the very beginning, I'm really happy I turned to teaching and research and not working in industry. But like the challenges, messed up choosing research methods, being the first person on my campus to do research in education, one of the few women in the college, helping education research community grow as a whole. Human interactions are hard. family and career, you know, my kids are the most important thing to me, you know, and I hope that comes through in my life, but you know, you get on automatic pilot. And so like, those are the external things. The internal things, you know, it's so easy to take something and have it affect your confidence, you know, imposter syndrome. I let things affect my identity. You know, that looking back, I'm like, oh, you know, wish I hadn't taken that so hard. And so some of the advice I think I'd tell myself, is, okay. So when I look back, like in this somewhat coherent story, I seem to have been risk-seeking in my career, but the things that made it work was working with fabulous people. So finding people is super important. And then coming back to why you're doing it in the first place is really important. And there's a metaphor that I keep coming back to. Have you heard about David Foster Wallace? He started this a commencement speech he gave. So David Foster Wallace started a commencement speech he gave a decade or so ago. There are these two young fish and they're swimming along in the water, and an older fish comes swimming the other direction. And the older fish says to the two young fish, "Morning, how's the water?" And the two young fish keep swimming along. And then one of them turns to the other and says, "What the hell is water?" I'm like, oh, I now do pottery and I'm doing various versions of this, of the two fish. Like, it's so hard to figure out what you're doing along the way. Like, it's so hard to know what's the context. It's so hard to realize you're in the water. And then your water's not the same as somebody else's. And you get on automatic pilot and you work too hard and you don't exercise. And you know, at the field level, it's like the water in engineering education is way different than it was in 37 years ago. But us as individuals every single day need to remember that we're in the water. And we in the US, when we meet somebody, we say, "Hi, what do you do?" and we mean, how do you earn your money? And I think we need to change that, you know, because whatever anyone does to earn the money is the only part of what they do. You know, our identities are bigger than that. And it's really easy in this job, in this field, to let our job and academic life take over. But, you know, I'm a mom, I'm a wife, I'm an artist, I'm a neighbor, I'm a friend, a citizen, someone who cares about equity and social justice. But like, I could work 12 hours a day every day if I wanted to, right? And we all could. And so in thinking about, like, if I could tell young Cindy, exercise, but I would say, know your values and what you'll compromise on and what you won't. Be your own agent and don't give your power away, because self-respect comes from self. It can't come from anyone else. It has to come from self. And follow your heart and do what's important to you. You know the layout, when to push and when not to. Be in it for the long haul, like give up sometimes because you know that you can win the next battle. And value the people you work with. You know, find multiple mentors, find collaborators who build you up, not tear you down. And then love the quest and the questions, because the quest is the journey and the questions are why you're there. And you can tell I really love quotes. You can tell I really love quotes. So I'm going to end with one, another one that's a driver for me. It's Rilke. And he says, be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue. Do not now seek the answers which cannot be given you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. And I want to make a total shout out to Jennifer Turns, who was the first person who came to work with me at Celt in 1998 with an NSF postdoc. And she's been my colleague for decades. And she is just this most amazing person who has so much wisdom that is really couched in realism, a lot of energy, a huge dose of humor. And she's really in the game for changing the system over the long run. And it's been just a delight to work with Jennifer across the decades. And then the other thing is, I think that kept me going is coming back over and over again to why I was doing it in the first place. So to help engineers make better decisions about what we're doing and the impact that we have in the world. And then realizing that it wasn't just me, it's not just my research that's gonna do it, but it's the research of the whole community that's gonna do it. And so supporting the whole community is really super important. So our community is asking fabulous questions and will hopefully like live into the answers and then be able to affect what's happening in engineers, but not give up our own individual selves along the way. So that's what I would say to younger Cindy.
Wow.
It's lovely.
Love it. Yeah. I can't thank you enough for making time. And again, for the reflection, clearly the reflection that went into the preparation for this discussion. We will be your accountability partners for posting your profile. But for now, you know, at least people get to hear your voice. And your perspective through this. There's so much more that I know you could say and we could say. So I can't thank you enough for at least giving us a slice of your time. Thank you all for listening to today's podcast. So until next time, remember to keep it simple.
But significant.